Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for calling in this morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and this morning we have three guests with us. We have a guest from Women in Transition, which is a Philadelphia-based nonprofit organization helping women deal with the issue of nonviolence and domestic violence issues. Debossery Ghosh is the Education and Training Coordinator for Women in Transition. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Joy, for having me.
We also have Tanya Lovelace. She's the project manager for the Women of Color Network. They are connected to the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. It is a private nonprofit organization working at the state and national levels to eliminate domestic violence. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be on.
Thank you. We also have Juan Carlos Arian. He is a senior program director for the Family Violence Prevention Fund. That is working under the Founding Fathers, which is a subgroup or subdivision of the Family Violence Prevention Fund. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. I want to also remind the listeners, there are people listening on the computer, and there are also people who are calling in. The number is 646-929-0368. If for some reason you get disconnected with your computer, you can call in and listen to the show. If you are logged in on your computer, you can also chat with me. And in the chat screen, I've typed in the web addresses for Women in Transition, the Women of Color Network, and for the Founding Fathers website, so people can check those out after the show is over. I want to thank the people for calling in this morning. And I want to just say that this month is Teen Dating Violence Month, and I was talking to Juan Carlos about how disconcerting that was for me because I'm a mother. I have a daughter, and it just seems odd, the whole sentence, teen dating violence, that someone at a young age would have to deal with intimate violence. Statistics from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence state that one in every four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime. There are estimated 1.3 million women who are victims of physical assault by an intimate partner each year. 85% of domestic violence victims are women. And between 20 and 24 years of age, they are at the greatest risk of non-fatal intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. I think what also is important to note that children are affected by domestic violence, even if they are not directly being hit or punished or verbally abused. Witnessing the violence affects children. I know some issues when women try to leave, the issue of murder arises. So it's probably very scary for, I know people say, well, why do they stay? Why do the women stay? But, you know, some of them are afraid for their lives. And unfortunately, statistics I know show that women, when they do actually try to leave, the potential for murder is very high. Mm-hmm. The cost on our economy for dealing with this issue based on the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence is exceeding $5.8 billion a year to deal with this issue of domestic violence. Because it does not just stay in the home. It goes into people's workplaces. It affects their health. It affects their emotional state, so they may have to reach out for therapy. The children, it's a wide-reaching issue that is not just in the home. It comes into our society. I, again, want to thank the guests for coming on this morning. I guess to each of you, and I'm going to start with Ms. Ghosh first, how does it start? Is a boy and a girl, they meet, we're happy, we're in love. What happens? I mean, are there signs? What happens in that process? Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I think if we're talking specifically about teenagers, there definitely are signs. There are so many challenges that teenagers face these days as it is with peer pressure, self-esteem, fitting in. And a lot of them don't have models for healthy relationships. They're not sure what healthy relationships look like. If they, you know, don't see that with their parents, if they, you know, obviously aren't seeing that in the media, they don't know, you know, where to turn. They don't know what that's supposed to look like. So it's natural that they'll fall into patterns where, especially with the technology, we'll see the constant texting, the constant social networking. And it can get a little obsessive. It usually starts with that kind of emotional abuse, what we call it, and then sometimes it does escalate to the physical abuse.
Yes, the kids these days have to deal with the web, their phones, the texting. So I guess in the past, maybe people might call on the phone, a regular phone, not a cell phone, come to a person's house. But now you have the technology supporting, I guess, a sense of stalking.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And we see that with adults as well, but I think it's particularly dangerous with the teenagers because they don't recognize it as a problem. They see it as very flattering often, and they see it as a normal course of action. And it can become very dangerous when you're constantly being monitored by your partner and you constantly are having to check in. That sets a very dangerous precedent.
Right. Juan Carlos, why don't you speak to the issue of young men in relationships with these young women that she's talking about? What is going through their minds? What have they told you is going through their minds when they're doing this behavior?
Right. Well, you know, it's as you know, a complex issue. But even though maybe the violence starts manifesting itself in adolescence and sometimes later, the truth is that probably the roots of the problem go back earlier than that. And there's some research now showing some connections between, for instance, bullying behavior in elementary school and dating violence. And I think in my mind, at least, a lot has to do with how kids are socialized, how they learn how to be boys and how girls learn to be girls in our society. The role of the media, for instance, is huge. How kids are learning to be a man or to be a woman, and
right.
if there's not a lot of parent involvement, and the peers will be the guide of how to do this. So you know, just turn on the television, and you will see all the roots of the problem in some way, right? The male entitlement, you know. These boys and young men are basically taught that you know women are objects, that they should comply to their wishes and so on. And I think that's the beginning of the problem. And I do think that it can be counteracted by parents and other adults being involved with the kids. But the messages out there are so blunt in some ways.
So. Debossery, what should a young lady or a young woman or a woman do? Okay, so this is happening to me. And Juan Carlos mentioned the psychological aspect of it. It may not even become physical. It starts with the psychological, with the name calling, with, you know, who are you talking to, where are you going, what are you doing?
Right.
And what do you tell the young woman if she believes that she's in a situation? I mean, what can constitute abuse, really? Because people have arguments in relationships all the time. You might unfortunately call your partner a name, you might storm out, you might question where they're going. Is that abuse? I mean, at what point does it become abuse?
Well, I think the threshold is much lower for teenagers. I don't think there should be very much name calling or insulting or serious fighting in a teenage relationship. If there is, it's probably time for that relationship to end. It may have run its course. It may not have been abusive, but at that age, when you're still developing your self-esteem and your self-identity, I don't think you really need to be in a relationship where you're constantly being insulted and manipulated in that way. But I would say if a young woman comes to you and has these concerns, to let her know that it's not normal, because she may be, if she's talking to her friends, she may hear, that's great, you know, he calls you all the time because he loves you, he gets jealous because he loves you, and you really need to counteract that mentality. And that's, you know, that's a common teenage mentality. They don't mean any harm when they tell their friends that. But as adults, I think we have a responsibility to talk to teenagers honestly and say, you know, I know that your friends might be telling you that this is flattering and this is positive, but in reality this is a serious problem and could lead to much more dangerous situations down the road. And I would have a frank conversation with them about the prevalence of domestic violence and about the prevalence
right.
of teen dating violence and the possible fatalities.
You have a 1-800 number. You have a telephone hotline that people can call in, correct?
We do. We have the Philadelphia Domestic Violence Hotline, and that number is 1-866-SAFE-014. It's a 24-hour hotline, 24 hours, 7 days a week, where anyone can get counseling, support, shelter referrals, if that's what's needed. Women in Transition also has a lifeline. That's for people who aren't in so much crisis, but mm-hmm. maybe in that situation where they're having questions, they don't know if this is normal,
right.
need some support. And that number is 215-751-1111.
Now, Tanya Lovelace, again, she's here from the Women of Color Network. I'm a friend of someone who is going through this issue, and I know your organization supports activists who are trying to fight this issue. What types of services do you have in your organization? If I'm someone, I know people who are involved in this, and I really want to make a change in my community, what does your organization offer?
Well, yes. With the Women of Color Network, our mission is to provide leadership and technical assistance, resources, and support to women of color advocates and activists around the country. And when we say women of color, we mean women of African, Asian, Latin, and Native descent. And so we really serve as a networking space and a space for women to develop and to build their capacity around various issues. We're not focused just on domestic violence, and although domestic violence is a primary focus, but we do also address and look at sexual assault, stalking. We also look at dating violence, and we look at other levels of violence as well. And so another resource that we provide are fact sheets, and one of our current fact sheets is on dating violence in communities of color. And I just wanted to add that, you know, to the conversation and to say that in 2005, Black, non-Hispanic, and Hispanic students were more likely than white students to be victims of dating violence. And so it's important for us to recognize that it's of greater, the numbers are higher within the communities,
yes.
And it's important to really understand that. And in terms of supporting people who are interested in addressing this work or addressing these issues, we have leadership trainings that we do. Our most recent one was through the Office on Violence Against Women. It allows us to support women of color and provide them with information they wouldn't otherwise have access to, information around public policy and how to make a difference there, also in terms of providing advocacy around criminal justice and other areas. And so we try to build women's capacity there and also to support them in terms of their understanding of management and how to reach further into this movement. What we know at this point is that most of the programs within the Violence Against Women movement at this time are led largely by white women and white men. And that's not necessarily a problem, except for the fact that it's important to have more leadership from communities of color to ensure that those communities of color are better reached and better understood. And so we work alongside other organizations like the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, alongside Alianza, which is a group that Juan Carlos is also connected to, as well as Asian Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence, that we are those national groups that really work to ensure that the voices of communities of color are out there and are recognized.
Yes, that's very important, especially since you're saying that the statistics show people of color are at a higher rate to deal with this matter. Juan Carlos, why don't you speak to the issue of some of the initiatives you're doing with men to deal with this issue? How can men support ending the violence against women?
Well, thank you very much for the question and actually for having me in the program, because I think, as we were chatting before the program, I think it's really important to recognize that men have to be involved. And I still think that this movement has to be led by women, but I think men have to play a very important part of the movement, and in fact are playing more and more a part in the movement. I think more and more people are recognizing that. So at the Family Violence Prevention Fund, we actually have various initiatives that have engaged men in from different angles. You mentioned the Founding Fathers campaign, which it started as a campaign of men in prominent positions like athletes, politicians, and so on, signing a declaration basically saying that you know, enough is enough, that we will not tolerate this anymore in our society. You were mentioning the statistics, which are, you know, alarming by any measure, basically. So that's
also mention that men are also victims of domestic violence. I mean, majority of the victims are women, but men are also victims and also have been murdered in relation to the issue of domestic violence.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's important to mention. And it's also important to mention that sometimes the perpetrators of that violence are other men. So it can go both ways. But yeah, you're right. You're totally right about that. And I think historically we have seen men as the problem in this issue. And, you know, clearly, you know, statistically, yes, we can see that. But I think we are starting to shift and see men also as part of the solution, and I think that is so important. And a key element with all of our programs, Founding Fathers, or another big program that we have called Coaching Boys into Men, which is basically encouraging men to talk to boys in their lives, that's, I think, a key thing that every man can do, because maybe the listeners, maybe men on the street will say, well, you know, I'm not abusive. What's my role here? I think every man and every woman, for that matter, could play a key role by teaching the next generation that this is just not okay, you know?
Yes, you have a coach's toolkit, I believe, on your website that men in the community can download, and it kind of gives them guidelines on how to work with young men in their neighborhoods and their communities. So listeners, you can go to the endabuse.org, and I believe if you look up Coaching Boys to Men, that they will find the toolkit.
That's correct, yeah.
Yes.
We have a whole program of working with athletic coaches, yes.
That's good. Now, you mentioned about signing a declaration on the Founding Fathers website. Men can go as a form of solidarity to sign. Could you speak about the declaration and how it came about?
Yeah, the declaration, it's actually one of different campaigns that are happening both in the U.S. and globally. Another big one is called the White Ribbon Campaign. And it's basically this idea of men publicly standing up and saying, you know, this is we oppose this. So you can go on the website and sign your name and add it to the list of people globally of men that are saying we won't take that. So recently, I heard in Brazil, the president of Brazil spearheaded a similar campaign and is hoping to collect 1 million signatures from men to bring to the UN. And I think this is an idea whose time has come. One of the big supporters of the Violence Against Women Federal Act and of this whole thing, as you know, is probably is Vice President Joe Biden.
Yes.
And I think President Obama is really a living example of what it is to be an honorable man that is respectful and has an equal relationship with his wife and a wonderful father at the same time. So I think this is a great time to look up to our leaders
yes.
That person. Yeah.
Now, Debasri, how are children affected by this issue? I mentioned earlier, even if they're not there, being beaten or put down, but they're watching this violence in their homes. Could you speak to some of the effects that children go through, some of the issues that they have to deal with?
Well, children, we always talk about the silent victims of domestic violence because they are often in the home, and even when you know, people think that kids don't pick up on these kinds of things, kids are very perceptive and very smart, and they usually know what's going on. And, you know, I think it's something like 8.8 million children witness domestic violence in their homes each year. It's a huge number. And when you talk about the cycle of violence, 50 to 70% of those children who witness domestic violence are also victims of child abuse. They're twice as likely to abuse their own partners when they become adults. They're, you know, at much greater risk to exhibit depression, anxiety, violent behavior, as adults. So it definitely plays into these children's psyches and affects the way that they grow and what kind of adults they grow into. It's also
now, what are I know I think I talked to one of you earlier about the issue of a safety plan. Again, what if the person is in a situation, what can they do to get out, or what are some steps they could take to get out of this violent situation?
Well, I think identifying the situation as abusive is a great first step because you can start to plan ahead. So first, I would recommend identifying support? Are there family members that the person can talk to? Are there friends? Is there a physician? Can they talk to someone at work? And then, you know, figuring out who among that support network would be able to provide them with certain resources, a place to stay, a place to keep their things, develop a plan for the children. And, of course, we always encourage anyone who's experiencing any kind of domestic violence to call the hotlines and talk with a trained counselor to work around the safety plan, because the safety plan is very individualized. It has to do with the specific details of a person's, you know, life and relationship and situation.
Well, what do you say to the woman when the guy is telling her, well, if you leave me, I'm going to kill you? Mm-hmm. Where can they go? Does your organization provide places and locations that women can go to so that they're not found?
There is a domestic violence shelter here in Philadelphia run by one of our partner organizations, Women Against Abuse. That is an option for some women, but it isn't an option for everyone. You know, when people call the hotline, we don't immediately tell them, you know, this is how you should leave and this is why you should leave. At Women in Transition, we really focus on empowerment counseling, which means that a woman chooses her own action, that she's empowered to figure out her own path. And that may be, at that very moment, staying in the relationship and managing it for a little bit longer while she figures out the best way to leave in the future. But we don't want anyone to rush into such a huge decision, especially considering that right after a woman leaves an abusive relationship is the time that she's most likely to face fatal harm. So this is not a decision to be made lightly, and that's why we do so much work around safety planning to make sure that all of the ducks are in line before any drastic action is taken.
That's good. Now, Tanya, I don't know if you can speak to this issue. There's a lot of new laws on the table dealing with workplace policies around domestic violence, allowing people to take time off because of domestic violence issues. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I'm aware of it.
Can you speak to some of the particulars? I mean, what exactly does it mean? A person can take off a day, a week, a month? Is there special paperwork? Do they have to get stuff from a doctor? How do you know the process of how they can go about taking advantage of that?
I'm aware of it, and unfortunately, I don't have all of the details, but my understanding of it is that because domestic violence does affect the workplace in such drastic ways, you know, many of the women who are in these relationships do work and are trying to maintain their jobs, and the way that a batterer can further reinforce abuse is to abuse her in the workplace or to create an environment where she potentially could lose her job because he has battered her to the point where it's difficult for her to come back to work, or does engage in some stalking or some abusive behavior by showing up at the workplace. And I believe that those laws were put into place to provide her some support from the workplace where she can take some documentation to her employer and can be so that it can be recognized and that the agency can then also engage in a safety planning process and can be of a support to her as opposed to then being used as a part of the abuse that the batterer has set up around her. One of the things that makes it difficult for a woman to leave is if she does lose her financial support. And so it's important for her to have those finances so that she can make some decisions about what she's going to do and how she can do that. And so it really does empower the workplace to be in a better place to assist her with that. I do believe that Juan Carlos, isn't the Family Violence Prevention Fund pretty directly involved with the workplace issues?
Yes, I'm not, but some of my colleagues are. So you can, again, go to our website, nabuse.org, and there's a whole section on workplace issues, and you can get more information there.
Okay. I just want to take a minute to read. This is from a book called Bruising Souls by Dr. Sandra Maria Folzer, dealing with violence within the home. And this is a quote from an abuser, a male abuser. He says, I am capable of inflicting abuse upon someone. Being a man, I am in need of controlling my partner. This is all because society at large projects that man must not be any other way. We are easily manipulated into not seeking out our own sensitivity. We would rather repress it and develop abusive behavior. The worst part of all is I can become verbally abusive, breaking down my partner's self-esteem just so I can feel as if I can be the boss or feel content with my own manhood. Now, Juan Carlos, maybe you could speak to what if a guy is abusing his wife or partner, what are some things he can do to try to bring down the violence? What are steps? Should he go talk to someone? Is there a place he can call? Support groups? What can he do?
Well, that's a very good question. This is the kind of problem that it's very difficult to take care of by yourself, you know. But the good news is that there is help out there. As it was mentioned with victims, I think that the first step, of course, is realizing that you have a problem, you know. So when folks realize that they have a problem and they are over the, at least the initial denial, there are programs, they are called Batterers Intervention Programs, and every community, or at least every big city and locality, has them at this point. You can actually call your local Battered Women's Organization or the state coalition in your state, and most of them have a list of certified programs. And not all states certify them, but it's the states that do, it's important that it's a certified program, a program that is working with integrity and transparency and in collaboration with the women's organizations. But those programs are designed basically to help men. We don't call them support groups per se. It's more an educational group to really critically examine some of these issues that you were mentioning before, around socialization, around the need to control, around the repression of our own feelings that are all connected in some way. And for some men, and I have to emphasize this, these groups can be effective with some men. There's men that through these groups and through very hard work can stop being violent. But there's other men that do not. So that's also very important to mention. Even if men go to these programs, some of the men will not stop being violent. And in those cases, we need a criminal justice approach for sure, you know, to the issue.
Yes. There's a women's law project. DeBossery, does your organization work with them here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania?
We do. Mm-hmm. Work closely with them. One of the systemic barriers, in addition to all of the, you know, the barriers in one's personal life, one of the systemic barriers is lack of legal assistance for many of these women. As Juan Carlos mentioned, at a certain point, the criminal justice system often does have to get involved. So the Women's Law Project is wonderful at providing legal counsel regarding, you know, protection from abuse orders, custody issues, divorce, as well as other issues that survivors of domestic violence face.
Now, this issue around men, again, I just want to go back to you, Juan Carlos. I know you're working with the Men's Resource Center for Change. What are some of the things that you do there for that organization? Is that still going on, or is that in the past?
That's in the past, actually. That's an grassroots organization in Massachusetts where I worked for 10 years, and we did some of the work that I was describing before. I do want to make a point around the effects on violence on children, which is something, as Ms. Ghosh was describing, it's very dramatic. It's something that just in the last few years we have realized that how damaging the exposure is, not only the direct abuse, but I think it's also important to mention that kids are resilient, and there are some very important protective factors too that we have to take into consideration, and some good research is coming around this. So while it's true that, for instance, most men who batter grew up in abusive households, it's also true that most boys who grow up in abusive households do not go on to be batterers themselves. And I think that's a very important point in terms of hope for this. And I think the key question for me is why? Why do some boys become batterers and some don't when in similar circumstances? And I think the research is showing us that the presence of a stable, loving adult in their lives, of course, preferably the non-abusive parent, but also it could be a step-parent or a coach or a teacher, that can make a dramatic difference in children. both for domestic violence and community violence, by the way. So again, going to back to this idea that both men and women, but men who are listening to this program, we can all play a dramatic role, not only with our own children, but other children in our lives, other boys. And we can really counteract the effects of media, of community violence, and so on by sending a very clear message that this is behavior is not okay, you know?
Yeah. Well, I also want to mention that a lot of times people think abuser, big, burly, you know, cigar smoking, you know, not shaven, beer drinking, but it could be corporate America CEO making, you know, six figures. It could be the businessman on the corner. There is not a certain look to an abuser. So I know people say, well, how did she get in that relationship? Didn't she know? I mean, couldn't she tell that he was going to do that? No. I have a friend personally I know who came to me and was in this situation, and the guy was a businessman. He had his own business. He had a nice car. He had a home. On the outside, he looked like a good guy, and it didn't start out like that. He was nice to her. He got her flowers. I mean, he took her to dinner. He was nice to her kid. And then as time went on, the situation changed. So I think that's an important point also, that an abuser does not have a label on their forehead. I'm an abuser. Of course, I'm sure there are certain individuals that you come across in your life, you know right away, you probably shouldn't be involved with them. But on the other side, there are many individuals that do not have a stereotypical look to them. We have a caller. I just wanted to bring her on here. I think it's a 202 number. Good morning, caller.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. What's your name?
My name is Leanne.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for calling in. Do you have a question for one of our guests?
Yes. I think that one of the things I wanted to ask about was when people have been, I was in an abusive relationship many, many years ago, but it took me a very long time to get the kind of therapy and help to kind of cut through old patterns in terms of repeating that kind of situation. And I'm wondering how they encourage women who may have gotten out of abusive relationships but who may not have really changed that tendency in terms of learning how to take care of themselves.
Who would like to speak to that? The Bossery?
Sure, I'll take that question. I think personally our philosophy is, as I mentioned, one of empowerment and one of support. So you're absolutely right that the process doesn't end when you leave the relationship. It's an ongoing process of rebuilding your self-esteem. If you're constantly being, you know, emotionally abused, physically abused, manipulated, insulted, that's going to take a toll on your psyche. And even if you are, you know, strong enough and powerful enough to leave the relationship, you still have to take care of yourself and make sure that you're in a place where you're not going to fall into old habits and repeat past behaviors. And I think that's all about, you know, reclaiming yourself, reclaiming your ability and your personal power to make changes in your life. If you can make such a drastic change as to leave an abusive relationship, that really speaks to how much you can do personally within yourself. Of course, ongoing support. I would always encourage joining a peer support group or just keeping in touch with friends, checking in with people, letting them know how you are, and developing those meaningful relationships that I think really lead to meaningful, long-lasting, positive change.
Thank you very much. Thank you, caller. Did you have any other comments? Or? Okay, I just wanted to, Tanya, maybe you could give the number for the Women of Color Network. I know we talked earlier about you having scholarships for people who want to become advocates against domestic violence or other violence issues, like you said, the issue of rape and things of that nature. Is there a phone number they can call to learn more about how to get support to start a group in the area?
Yes, the phone number is 800-537-2238. And again, we are a project of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence, as well as the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence. And so when callers call in, they will hear Pennsylvania Coalition, but you just ask for the Women of Color Network, and they will make sure that you reach our office.
Do you have any upcoming conferences dealing with this issue in the future, Tanya?
What we have coming up in August is some work that we're going to be doing with women of color advocates as well as with mainstream advocates And the goal here is to support the relationship building between those that represent communities of color and those advocates who are trying to reach out to communities of color. And that training is going to be taking place in Arizona. That will happen in August.
Okay. And Juan Carlos, could you also tell your website again and a phone number people can call about Founding Fathers to learn more about that program?
Sure, happily. The website is endabuse, like E-N-D-A-B-U-S-E, .org, and it really offers a lot of good resources especially for practitioners in the field about these issues. And the phone number, we don't have an 800 number, but we are based in San Francisco, and the phone number is 415-252-8900. And if you want to get involved on the Founding Fathers, there's a website, foundingfathers.org. And as you mentioned, people can download materials, for instance, the Coaching Voicing to Men toolkits and so on, for free from the website.
Thank you. And DeBosri, could you also repeat your hotline phone number again and your website address?
Sure. The Women in Transition Lifeline number is 215-751-1111, and the 24-hour Philadelphia Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-866-SAFE-0143, and our website is www.helpwomen.org.
Now, the Valsari, I read that Eve, she's a singer-performer, very famous, chose your organization for something very special. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Sure. Eve selected us for the Cartier Love Charity. This is an ongoing event that Cartier does every year where they select certain celebrities to sponsor a charity of their choice. And Eve selected us, which meant that we, in addition to getting some of the proceeds from a few Cartier items, she spoke about us at a large press conference. Eve is from Philadelphia, so she has sort of a personal connection here. And we are very excited to spread the word about women in transition and about domestic violence as an issue in general. It was a very exciting event.
Now, where can people purchase? Is the bracelet still for sale?
I believe they are still for sale, and I think you can link to the Cartier website from our website, helpwomen.org.
And what are some of the initiatives you guys are working on for the future? Do you have any events coming up in the future?
We do. The Teen Dating Violence Awareness Week just ended, but we are doing trainings for the rest of the month around that issue. Our newest initiative is a safety, self-defense, and assertiveness program called WAVE, Women's Anti-Violence Education. And we're doing trainings all over the city around this issue to prevent sexual violence. And they're very interesting trainings. They're about half physical resistance skills, and the other half is sort of discussion around boundary setting, assertiveness, using your voice, de-escalating situations. So that's sort of our newest initiative at Women in Transition.
One of the things I am reading, this issue of the psychological and the physical, that a lot of times the psychological is harder to suppress. The psychological abuse is harder to deal with than the physical. Juan Carlos, can you speak to that issue of how that affects women, the psychological abuse? And I guess some people actually deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. having been years of a domestic violence situation. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, you often hear survivors saying exactly what you are saying. Those are the voices of survivors, that the physical abuse, the wounds heal eventually, even broken bones heal, right? But what you were describing before, the systematic degradation, destruction of the self-esteem of the partner and things like that are very hard to overcome. You know, that takes a long, long time. And in some way, that is the core of abuse. I think people don't often think it that way, and they just think about the physical. But in terms of the tactics that men who batter use, really the core of the coercion and of the control is in the psychological and emotional abuse, reinforced, if you will, by the physical and sexual abuse. And this is another thing that we shouldn't leave out. These things are connected, although the field sometimes, we work with some artificial separation, the sexual assault field and the domestic violence. Of course, there's quite a bit of overlap. And
yeah, definitely. Men
who use violence use sexual violence with their partners too, to basically reinforce the reign of terror, if you will.
Yeah.
So and I think on the other side, with men who are working on changing their patterns, it's a similar thing. I think it's I won't say easy, but stopping the physical violence is it's easier than stopping all the controlling behavior,
right,
all the psychological violence. And the sexual violence, sometimes it's even a taboo. Of sometimes these programs don't even approach it because it's such a taboo. Yeah.
I have another caller here. Hold on a second. Good morning, caller. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi. What's your name?
Hi. My name's Kelly.
Okay. Hi, Kelly. Good morning. Thank you for calling in. Where are you calling from, Kelly?
I'm in Norwalk, Connecticut.
Thank you. Do you have a question or a comment for today's show?
I am sorry. I joined you guys really late.
Okay.
I'm sort of catching up, and I just wanted to listen, and I've never done Blog Talk Radio before, so I apologize. But
that's okay. Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. That's all right. Well, I hope you continue to listen to the show. And afterwards, just for all the listeners, there are people in the chat room. I texted them the information, the website addresses, and I know there are callers on the computer. I want to say thank you for calling in today. And you can listen to the archive of the show if you did call in late or you're not able to hear for some reason on your computer. You can listen to the archive afterwards, and you can go to www.blogtalkradio.com/joykeith. I want to thank our guest today, Devasri Ghosh from Women in Transition, Tanya Lovelace from the Women of Color Network, and Juan Carlos Arian from the Family Violence Prevention Fund. I want to thank you very much for calling in and sharing your knowledge and your resources with the listeners today. I want to close today's show. I want to read a poem. It's by Maya Angelou. It's called I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings. The free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream to the current end and dips his wings in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The cage bird sings with fearful trill of the things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the cage bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze, and the trade winds soft through the sighing trees, and the fat worms waiting on the dawn bright lawn, and he names the sky his own. But a cage bird stands on the grave of dreams. His shadow shouts on a nightmare scream. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The cage bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the cage bird sings of freedom. And that is by Maya Angelou. I thought it was apropos because I think when you're in a situation like domestic violence, you feel caged and not able to get out, and you're looking for a window of hope. Again, I want to thank the guests today for coming in to talk about this very important issue. And again, the Women in Transition is www.womenintransitioninc.org, the Women of Color Network.org, and endabuse.org are three websites that you can go to get more information, more resources, and connect with people in your community to try to make a change about this issue. Thank you very much, callers, and I'll see you next week. We'll be dealing with how to develop a healthy relationship next week with the Council for Relationships, which is a Philadelphia-based mental health provider. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.